Providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we welcome Roger Q. Mason. He is a playwright, a screenwriter, a producer, and a director. He does film and he does theater, and we have a very lively chat. Here's Roger.
Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, my God, Sherry. I have to tell you, the weather needs to decide what it wants because it's raining 1 minute, then it's 75 degrees, then it's like winter. I mean, what are we doing? It's a very tumultuous moment of transition, both in the air and also, you know, on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, we're just doing all the transitions all at once. So all we can do is just sit and enjoy a couple of cookies and hot cocoa and keep it moving, because that's pretty much what we got at this point.
The last time there was a hearing like this, I was a little girl and I was getting mad because it was interrupting my cartoons and my repeat shows that I used to watch.
Right. I mean, I
the
can't even sit
watch
these
thing.
Hearings, but, you know, I mean, if I sat and got sucked into MSNBC or CNN, I would never leave my television. So I just, you know, you read what you need to, you get the gist of what's going on, you get your little updates, and then you keep going about your own way, because that's all we can do, you know, is the rest of the world may be going crazy, but as long as we can keep our little fiefdoms somewhat sane, we've pretty much done a damn good job. That's how I'm looking at this.
Yeah, that's true, and that's what I do too. I don't watch it. It's just too much, and I'd rather just read the bits and bobs and see what's going on,
yeah.
And that's it. You know, I don't want to get involved.
Exactly. We don't want to get involved, because once you go down that rabbit hole of getting involved, then it consumes you, you know. And, you know, I'm watching this show right now called The Sinner. I'm watching it on, I think it's originally on USA Network, but it's now on Netflix or something. And I'm watching season 3, which is the Matt Bomer season. And it's following a certain philosophical premise. I think it's a Nietzsche premise. I'm not really exactly sure, because they explained all of it in some very artfully done exposition in episode 5. Very well played exposition on that, because it was investigative, you know. So the best way to hide exposition is in a murder mystery, you know, because you can get away with it, because you've got to ask the question so we know. So it's very well done.
Yeah.
And the notion that sort of left the scene was the theory of search, of looking into the abyss, and that you can look into the abyss for the answers to life's mystery, to find fulfillment. But then at a certain point, if you look far enough down the abyss will look back at you.
That's really true. That is true. You get sucked in. It's one of the reasons that I use social media for my advertising, and I know to catch up on with friends and stuff like that, but I'm very selective about the amount of time I use it, because you get sucked right in.
It's designed that way. It's completely designed to get you to opt in and join a particular channel of thought production. And in doing so, become a part of that culture and contribute to it, not only by passively consuming it, but also by continuing to propagate its ideas and values. And I'm not talking on any side of the political spectrum on this. I'm literally just saying this is how information is disseminated now, and this is how social media and the algorithms are charting and forming and framing our thoughts. And if you think about it, we end up becoming part of self-selecting groups of idea makers. Because depending on who
the thing
you like,
I try to avoid, Roger. I am. I'm trying to avoid it. I'd rather go into, like, I belong to groups, but it's like TV show groups, like Fisher or Frankie Drake or Athena. Yeah, I try really hard not to get into any of that stuff because it's like too scary.
It's too much. And the thing about it, too, is where does it leave time for us to form our own thoughts and make
exactly.
our own and create our own opinions? You know, that's why I think you read the tidbits and you look at the things, but then ultimately you have to depend on yourself and on your own ideals to guide what decisions you make and what thoughts you have, because mm-hmm. you are your own person. You know, it's funny, and I think about what happened to people and their relationship to place and space after the invention of remember that navigation device that we used to, I mean, now it seems like a million years ago, the box. That was basically like a little satellite, and you'd go in taxis. I'm taking us back to the taxi days, okay? And they mm-hmm. had that box, like you'd type in the address, that huge clunky screen, and then it would speak to you in this robotic voice. I think at that very moment when we stopped reading maps and actually having to engage physically and actively in who we are and where we are and how do we get into and out of places, we developed a passive and receptive relationship to direction. And not
yes,
just
sir.
Physical direction, but I think philosophical direction. What does it mean to not be an active participant in your own direction making and decision making, to just say, oh, well, the app told me to go here? Well, what if the app told you to jump off a fucking cliff?
Yeah, I agree with that. It's scary. I'm an independent thinker. I was taught very young. I don't follow the little path.
No, it's scary to think, but think about, just look at driving, right? People are just, oh, just put it in the app. I don't want to think about it. I'll just listen to what it prompts me. But how does that passive relationship to direction affect your other functions? It must have some sort of broader neurochemical effect on you, because you are learning to respond to decision making in a different way in one aspect of your life. How does that affect the way you relate to other aspects of your life? So I'll say to some of these drivers, think, don't listen to that. Why drive through this construction zone anyway and have us both choke to death on this damn construction zone? Let's turn here and then go back around. I mean, just this simple kind of relationship to your life. Your life.
That's true.
It's just, oh my.
When I was a little girl, my dad used to say, okay, everybody, we're going to go get lost. And we'd pile into the car. We had no idea where he was going. He had no idea where he was going. And he just drives just to have fun. I mean, that's where my thinking flows.
that's absolutely powerful, because sometimes you need to just allow yourself to get lost to find out who you are and what you're made of. And you know, the funny thing is, that's how I found myself as an artist, was I spent the last 10 to 15 years allowing myself to get lost. Allowing myself to get lost, sometimes intentionally and sometimes unintentionally, and sometimes lostness was imposed on me, And I had to accept it. And in accepting it, find a way to find myself. And the process of finding myself, not the outcome, but the process of finding myself, is how I developed my voice and my instinct. And I wouldn't trade that self-discovery for anything in the world. I wouldn't trade it for a thing, because now I know how my instrument works and who I am and why I do what I do and how I do it. And that is priceless.
Yeah.
That is priceless.
I think that's one of the things I don't like about what's happening in the world right now. Everybody seems to be following voices in a box, like you said, called a TV or a laptop or whatever device you're watching. And they don't read. They don't, I mean, how many times when we were allowed to, did you go to a restaurant or a coffee shop and you saw people sitting with each other and they were all staring into their phones and no one was really communicating? I always got really upset when I saw that.
All the time. You see it all the time. And the thing is, because we're socially distant now and people are accustomed to either, you know, texting people or messaging or maybe FaceTiming for shorter periods of time. I think when we come out of this, the way that face-to-face communication it'll either become one of two things. It'll either become a novelty and something that people crave because they've been so deprived of interaction, or it'll become something that people are absolutely mortified by and don't want to do. And for those that
I hope it's the one about craving. I really do. I hope people are craving
it's going to be split. There's going to be enough people who were recluses already that are going to use this moment as justification for going into, you know, anonymity. That we know that. And then there's going to be all of us that love interaction who are going to say, oh, my God, I need to see everybody. And I mean literally everyone all at once, you know, and they're going to be craving it. So I think it'll go both ways, you know. I think it'll go both ways.
I really miss, like, going to the theater or a museum, you know, or even a movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I have to tell you, though, I'm kind of learning to love, in a way, streaming. Because what I've decided at this point is, like, I want to try new things. You know, I want to watch new things. Because as someone who's, you know, transitioning from theater into TV film work, I want to know what the conversations are, you know, in the medium that I'm seeking to join. And so I'll just watch something. I'll just choose something every night, and I'll just watch it. You know, sometimes it's planned, sometimes it's something that I've wanted to see for a while, and sometimes not. And just the exercise of sitting down and enjoying it and consuming it privately and, you know, in the comfort of my own room, there's something really interesting about that for me, because I get to experience things in terms of visual storytelling in a way that I feel I can't necessarily experience them in the same way going to the movie theater, because there's so many other distractions. There's the bathroom, there's the popcorn, there's more butter, there's people talking and coming late. There are all these other pageants that are part of the public experience. So, but I also feel like those are important because those are what make the movies the movies. You know, certainly being crunched up in a lobby and buying $20 gin drinks between acts at the theater is part of the experience of the show, especially if it's your own and no one knows you. You're sitting there as a writer of the show in a corner listening to people chat about the show. I don't watch my own play. I can't be in the audience watching. You know what I do when I write a show for the theater? I'll sit, like, everyone knows I've got my own little corner in the dressing room, and I'll just sit and I'll listen to the play, and I can tell by the energy in the room how it's going. But don't ask me to sit in the theater. I think that has changed for me too, because that goes along with knowing your instrument and being able to accept with grace and with constructivism, this is a snapshot of where this play is at this time. I'm using this production to learn things about the work. And from this production, if it needs to grow and change and evolve, I have the time to do that. So long as I am above ground and thinking and breathing, I can always change and I can always grow and improve. I stay believing those ideas. And that's what sustained me all of this time, because I've always been dedicated to trying something new. That's what I was saying on a phone call with a friend of mine this morning when I was taking my walk. I said, you know, what excites me about myself now is I'm learning that I never rest. I'm always reaching. I'm always trying to get the next thing, the next idea. Because if we don't continue to reach and grow, then we're not really using our instrument to its fullest potential. And
you're also not living.
And you're not living. And the fullest potential of an instrument is to know that its growth is never done, that there's always something more. That's the fullest potential. You never reach it. If you think you've reached it, then you're dead, because we're never done learning. As long as we're living, we're always gaining information, ideas, and knowledge, and we're growing. That's what I believe.
I agree with that. I think it's really interesting because one of the things that makes it interesting to talk to all different kinds of people is that everybody has their own way of following their path to doing what they're doing. Now, you were a theater writer. How did you get into that? Were you an actor, or were you always did you always write plays, or
yeah.
How did that
start? You know, it's interesting because I feel like you're very psychic. You could tell that the performer in me never died. You know,
mm-hmm.
you could tell that the little actor singer in me that was so interested in being heard and clapped upon as a child, never died. And you're absolutely right. You know, my story is one of compromise and appeasement. You know, until it wasn't. You know, I grew up here in Los Angeles, and I was the child of a Black and Irish dad, Filipino mother. I wouldn't call our home conservative, but I would call it somewhat myopic in terms of its definitions of social roles. And growing up, all I wanted to do was sing the blues. I just wanted to be a blues singer. That's what I wanted to do. And, you know, at my high school, middle and high school, it was run at the time by a gentleman who had experience on Broadway and had come back to education later on. And we had these programs called midday cabarets. I'll never forget. Basically at lunchtime, we'd put on 30-minute cabaret shows once a week or a couple times a month. And oh, I used to love that. And I used to love not only watching them, but also being in them. And then I would audition for the musicals and the plays. And every time I would, of course, I'd get the part, Sherry, because, you know, I'm me. And every time I'd get the part, I'd go so far as to the first rehearsal. And then my dad would come in and he'd say, Roger's not doing this play. And he'd take me off the stage. And it happened every single time. And the reasoning was that he was very concerned that I would become what at the time was called a sissy-ass artist. You know, there was a lot of gender policing in the 90s. They weren't the gay 90s that we want to romanticize them to be, you know, with old Will and Grace and Queer as Folk and all this. No, honey. It was very, very restricting time. It was a time of don't ask, don't tell, too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much a victim of that time, because I felt like my wings were clipped. Because had I been allowed to blossom into that performer early on, I could have avoided about 20 years of trauma and self-doubt and self-hate and self-censoring that I had to dedicate the next 2 decades to overcome. And what happened over the next 2 decades is quite simply, I evolved back to the unabashed, brave, and free version of myself at 12, who got up there and used to just sing. And now I sing on the page, because along the way I discovered writing and I discovered directing, because at first they were polite, art administrative, respectable places in the eyes of the family. I could be a gentleman of letters through the place of the writer or the director. Those were respectable places. But being an actor, that was not a respectable place, you know. The actor.
Isn't it weird that in the 20th century, in the 21st century, actors are still put into that position? It's ridiculous.
They're still criminalized. It's still criminalized, still exoticized, still, completely just, it's really awful. It's like ostracized. They're still seen as this source of sin because they are the source of fantasy. They're a source of fantasy. And fantasy is frightening when you live in a society that has such strictures and rules about it, because fantasy shows you your truth. Fantasy shows you who you wish you could be if society were not policing you.
That's true.
And
I think one of the reasons that we love movies is that we learn from them.
We learn who we really are. We learn that we are just as weird and just as sinful and just as murderous and just as gluttonous and just as lustful and just as in love and just as dreaming as we are when nobody's looking, when we're sitting by ourselves in the imaginative orb of our thoughts with nobody stopping us. We learn in that moment who we really are. And that's the power of movies. But what if you could live that truth all the time, every day? Now, I'm not saying, what if you could live in a movie? That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is, what if you could live in your most authentic and uncensored, unabashed, unashamed self every day? What if you could have that? What would you be then? My God, you would be powerful. You would be unstoppable. Because there's one thing that I have learned over the last 15 years. And you know what that is? It's I already knew at 12 when I was sitting there singing, swishing my hips, being every bit the sissy-ass artist that no one wanted me to be. I already knew who I was going to be in my 30s. I was already there, and it took the next 20-some years to get back to that place of embracing who that person was.
Yeah,
because
it's like we take several steps backwards in order to go forward. It's a constant back and forth.
Yeah, and the steps backward that we take are not our own; they are society's.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, I mean, it's people who try to stop you from expressing yourself in whatever way you want to express yourself that mess you up.
Absolutely. And so you spend your adolescence and your early adulthood trying to get back to a place of authenticity where you can just function, you know. And some people make it through that hurdle. Some people don't, and some people get tragically lost along the way. Some people get caught up in lives they never wanted to live somewhere along the way. I'm glad I got free.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, thank God.
I'm glad I got free because, Sherry, If I had done what other people wanted me to do, or I had been who other people wanted me to be, we wouldn't be talking.
That's true.
You know, there would be nothing for me to say because I would be holed up in some, you know, profession of respectability, wasting away, probably punctuated by a whiskey bottle.
Isn't that sad? Isn't it weird? I mean,
you know, that's a lot of people's reality.
I know. It's really
you
sad.
Know? And I think that the artists are blessed in that we get to live the lives that so many people, or I can't speak for all artists, but some of us get a chance to live the lives that many wish they could live. You know, whenever I say to people ask me, oh, what do you do? You know, when I'm just in an Uber or whatever, oh, I'm a writer, I'm a performer. They just light up in an almost childlike way. Oh my God, it's like they're seeing a clown at a birthday, and they're two. It's otherworldly. Something, some part of their psyche, some aspect of a life they had to leave behind has been lit up once again to be happy. They get to be
sort of
happy.
Like, it's sort of like the movie Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's just amazing the power. We're in almost the ambassador, the spiritual ambassadorship business. We're ambassadors of the spirit. That's what we're doing as artists, you know?
I think it's showing more now. I think people are actually realizing how important the arts and entertainment field is. I'm an author. I know that I've been getting people more notes about, and more of my books are selling because people are wanting to read, and people are wanting to watch movies, and people are wanting to watch TV shows. I mean, they're bored.
Because we're bored, but also we're down and out, and we're hopeless. We are in an endless purgatory, and we're looking for hope. And that's what artists always have provided to the human spirit, is hope.
Mm-hmm.
Some way.
Absolutely.
If not in reality, then some kind of spiritual transcendence, some way of transcending my current moment through my imagination, even if it's fleeting for that hour or that 2 hours or 2 weeks that I'm wrapped up reading a book or binging a show. I got to feel that I am somewhere else and somebody else in my dismal existence, which is going and droning on endlessly with no end or relief or hope in sight. For those moments, I was able to find joy. That's the power of what we... That's the power of who we are, and that's the power of our function. And, you know, when you're in a society that doesn't always value the arts, it's saddening because I think we are an essential business. Because if people are ill of spirit, people don't know where they've been or have some way of dreaming forward, they're dead. It's exactly what we said at the beginning of this conversation because, you know, what I was watching the little documentary series on the brain that is, I think it's being narrated by Emma Stone. And this particular episode was about memory. And the show was trying to query, why is memory so important to human survival if it is subjective and emotional and it's faulty? What purpose does it actually serve? And so they had a study. I forget which neuroscientific institute it was, but they had done a brain scan study where they had asked patients to recall certain events in their lives. And particular chambers of their brain were ignited electrochemically. And then they asked the same people to recall what would have happened next, the future, after that event. And the same neurochemical chambers were ignited. And so the theory was posited that the same parts of the brain that are involved with forming memory are also key to forming our imagination of the future. In other words, we remember things so that we can imagine how our future will be. Our future is dependent neurochemically on how we remember the past. And for me, that revelation, thank you, Emma Stone and writers of the documentary, it completely justified and revolutionized how I write and why I write, because I do a lot of historical revisionist work. And my work as a writer is very much centered on how do I use the past as a way of dreaming culture forward? How do we revive our relationship to the past in order to imagine a better, more equitable, and less biased future? And so this little tidbit that literally on a biological level, my work is in sync with how the brain actually functions, suddenly I realized, well, hell, I'm in line with what we are supposed to be doing and how we're hardwired to imagine change anyway. Wow. And I didn't even know that. And I wasn't even a brain surgeon, but I could just feel it. I could just. So maybe I am doing a kind of brain surgery too, Sherry.
I thought a show like that too. It was a different documentary, but it was basically the same thing. It's just, it's interesting that if you don't use a part of the brain, it will stop. It just, because like you, if you're like, you're moved over, you're not doing something that you usually did, and it's just, you kind of stopped using it, it'll just, it'll give that part of your brain to something that you are doing.
Right.
The brain is so complex and interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and if you think about it, going back to what we were saying earlier, how many people aren't using certain lobes of their brain actively, and how fast are those lobes atrophying, especially right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially.
That's scary, though, if you think about it. It's sort of scary.
Okay.
No, I was just going to, we're going to switch subjects a little bit. I had the pleasure of talking to one of the people from one of your works, Felicia, about Breathe.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that came about and what the concept was? Did it start the way it did and all that?
Yeah. Well, I did not write Breathe. I directed Breathe, and I developed Breathe as a show with Felicia, who was the writer and performer. Felicia Saunders was the writer and performer of that piece. And
right, but you worked together on it, right? It was the
We worked very closely together on that piece, because the way that it started was this. About a year and a half ago, in the wee days before Corona, I had just returned to Los Angeles from New York, where I was living for, I was there for about 6 months. I had three projects going on, different off-Broadway showings, and I was really on a roll. And then I came back to LA because I had a couple of things going on here. And I met with Felicia and her mother because they wanted me to direct Felicia in a revival of another person's solo show. There were a couple of candidates. They were looking to introduce Felicia to the Los Angeles theater market as a writer-performer because she was in transition. She had had some nice success in film and TV, but really wanted to strike out on her own. So she was looking for a showcase of her talent as a solo performer, because that's one of her specialties. So we looked at works by Charlene Woodard and works by Charlene and Anna Deavere Smith were two of the ones that I know about. And I said, well, that's lovely. And, you know, I think you'll get some nice interest in you as an interpreter of somebody else's work. But do you have a story that you could tell? And she said, oh, no, I'm an actor. I want to be an actor. I said, okay, well, think about it, because I think that both from a professional standpoint, in terms of your goal, trying to establish yourself in LA, but also from an artistic standpoint, you might find it more fulfilling to develop a piece of material that speaks from your perspective, because everything is branding now. I said it from that perspective too, a little mercenary perspective. I said, look, you do a nice interpretation of somebody else's play, you'll get a couple of write-ups and people will pat you on the back, and that's fine. But you tell your own story and invite people into your own lived experience, especially in today's political climate, you'll make the moves. So she came back a couple of weeks later and she said, oh, you know, I have something, but oh, it'll never work. I said, what is it? And she said that she had a short play about a civil rights leader named Sweet Alice Harris that she did as part of her MFA training at UCLA. And she had to write a solo show about this person. And so she said, well, I wrote the piece, but I want to share. I said, well, where is it? And she didn't want to show it to me first. She said, well, let me send you the interview. And she sent me the audio of this woman. And I said, oh, this lady is captivating as hell. So originally the piece was going to be her playing this woman. And we were wondering, well, is it just the 60s or is it a whole, you know, a whole lot of different parts of her life? Is it a biopic? What are we doing? And then as we were talking, Felicia started interjecting different personal connections and inroads to why different things that this lady was saying and different aspects of the woman's story would relate to her own. And I said, well, it seems as though this lady's life aligned itself really dynamically with your own journey towards self-discovery. And she said, yeah. I said, well, what if this piece evolves, and what if it's about your interaction with this woman? So then, you know, then we started having all these race rebellions again this past year.
Right.
And almost like a lightning rod, the play just took off, because all of this outpouring of micro and macro aggression that have really formed Felicia's life as a professional young woman trying to make it in various industries, make it in school, make it as an actor, and all the ways in which her color or perceptions of her color stopped her along the way from succeeding or reaching her fullest potential. It really became quite evident and quite real that she was a victim of systemic racism in our country, that the racism of our country had stymied her professional and personal growth, and that she was looking to this woman, Sweet Alice, as a kind of guiding light and mentor, but that the real story was not Alice's, but rather Felicia's coming into herself, using Alice as a possibility model. Now, here's where I come into play, because as a playwright primarily, I was very interested in how do I help this young woman, this was her first play, how do I help her structure this event? Not just as a director, but really as a script advisor. So that's why we say developed with Roger Q. Mason, because in addition to directing or interpreting the work in its production form, I was also part of the conversation to help form the narrative. Now, she also had a brilliant dramaturg. His name is Dylan Souther, and he did a lot of the hands-on work. He did most of the hands-on work. They brought me in every now and then to try and provoke new thoughts, because, you know, I'm a bit of a hellraiser, you know. you come up with a whole lot of stuff, and it's all going to be brilliant. Now, let me come in and kind of just knock at this and knock at that real quick and provoke some thoughts that nobody has thought about yet. And that's probably where I'm best suited, you know, and best able to help, because you need that second set of eyes to come into the room to really show you what you may have missed. Because when we're writing a play, we lose our objectivity very quickly. Because if we're doing our job, we get wrapped up and lost in the music of the work, if we're doing our job.
But that makes sense, though. It does, that you
know,
get wrapped. I always do when I'm working on a book. Sometimes I get, I drive in the wrong direction when I'm thinking about a book.
Yeah, I'll bring you back or say, no, I love this new direction. Now, how can you grow this? You know, one of the things that's interesting, especially when you're working with emerging writers, is a lot of your work is just encouraging them to trust their instincts, because so much of what stops us from writing is distrust. We don't trust ourselves. We don't trust what we naturally would have said, you know. For whatever reason, we censor ourselves. And a lot of the work of a good script editor or development consultant or dramaturg is to just help the writer come back to that fiery truth that started them on the journey to begin with. You already knew. You know, going back to me, I already knew at 12 when I was just trying to sing the blues. It took 25 years to get to a place where I could come back to what I already knew. God bless. Lord have mercy. I was already there. You mean I wasted 20? No, I didn't waste any time. Why? Because now, as Shakespeare says, now it is engendered. Can't take it away now. I know who I am, and I have 25 years of emotional evidence to back it up.
That's true. I love that. I think that's powerful and good.
You know, so that's the story. That's the story of how I came to be involved with Felicia's show. It started off as a project where they wanted me to just direct her doing another solo show, and what emerged was you know, a writer-performer relationship.
That's cool. Do you have projects that you're working on now? Anything that's coming out? Anything you would like to tell the audience about?
Yes, I have a couple of things that are coming up. Let me see what I can talk about and what I can't talk about. Okay, first of all, what I will say is, very soon, fingers crossed, I'm making a lovely leap into the TV film world. And so I'm very excited to be exploring the realms of television, particularly drama and also animation. Those are two things that I'm exploring right now. In addition to that, from my theater work standpoint, I have a new commission with Celebration Theater, which is going to discuss queer intimacy in the pandemic. It's a series of short pieces that we're going to do, which are going to be a little racy, I think, because we're going to probably be on that slightly pornographic site called OnlyFans. I've got a really exciting long-term commission with Leviathan Lab in New York for a play called Waiting for a Wake, which is sort of the Black and Filipino-American answer to Long Day's Journey into Night. And I'm starting that this month, and then it'll be a long-term development. We'll have a showing of that. We're trying to use it as a fundraiser for Asian American theaters around the country that are still in the pandemic trying to develop work by young artists. In addition to that, I have a commission with Courage Theater here in Los Angeles, which is a devised theater work about the failure of the healthcare system. So we'll be talking about that. And then I'm running, I'm the mentor for a really exciting new initiative with the Dramatists Guild and the National Queer Theater called New Visions Fellowship. I'll be the mentor to two trans and gender non-conforming Black playwrights who are at the earliest stages of their careers and are looking for mentorship, not only artistically, but also professionally. And how do they navigate this business, which is not always centering on the types and visions of inclusion that make space for Black, trans, gender non-binary ideas? So this is a national fellowship that I will be serving as the lead mentor on. We also will be having workshops with some of the best and brightest of queer writers and thought leaders around the country. So that is actually accepting applications now. I think we're accepting them through the end of February and part of March. So for anybody that's listening to this episode who identifies as transgender or gender nonconforming, please apply. It's national, just search National Queer Theater on Google, and the application is up there. And if you have any doubts, it's my face with a purple background.
Okay.
those are the things I can talk about. There's a lot going on that I can't yet, but those are the ones that I can discuss because they're publicly known.
It's weird. We were talking before, and it's just one of the things that with entertainment, everybody's got these really exciting projects that they can't talk about.
Oh yeah. No, we can't talk about a lot of them. You know, and the thing for me is like, there's no project too great or too small, too public or too private. They're all, you know, I do my best work sitting in a 30-seat theater, dusty as hell, just figuring out a scene. And that's who I'll always be at my heart, is a downtown New York, experimental theater artist trying to figure things out. You know, you can doll me up and put me in the fanciest rooms in the country, but that spirit of feeling fulfilled in this space at the fringes, you know, that's always where I find my most exciting innovations, is when I'm right at the fray, because there's something always funky to be found at the fray. You know, now I'm like so happy to be doing these national programs and working with fabulous fancy theaters in LA, like Courage Theater. I've loved their work for many years and wanted to work with them. Celebration Theater, big champion of my work here in LA. And, you know, I'm honored and grateful. Well, you know, if you'd have told me 15 years ago when I was doing readings, you know, at little places, you know, little reading festivals, that I was going to be working with these houses, I'd have told you were crazy, you know. Oh, and there's one other thing to say, because this is known. One of the writers of Page 73, very important new play development writers group in this country, Page 73, Interstate 73, some of the most exciting writers, many folks of whom I'm a huge fan in the New York Broadway, off-Broadway scene, coming through this program. So I'm one of the resident writers, writers in the writers group Interstate 73 at Page 73, based in New York. We're meeting virtually this year and then next year in person. So I'm very excited about that as well.
Cool. That's really cool. What is your, we're coming to the end. What is your social media? Oh, and do you have any kind of virtual events coming up?
Do I have any virtual events coming up? Okay, so
you know, like talks on writing,
so
movies or anything that you might be doing with the public.
Yeah, so the let me start with the socials, and then that'll jog my memory about what's coming up, because there's a lot coming up, but you know, some of it still got to be planned for, and some of it I can't talk about. But my social media, so you can just search me on Facebook as Roger, middle initial Q for Quincy, Mason. On Twitter, I'm just at Roger Q Mason with no punctuation. And on Instagram, I'm at RogerQ.Mason. And that's how people can find me on those. coming up that I can discuss right now. I know that the alumni spotlight of my work with the Fire This Time Festival, of which I'm a very proud alum in New York, the Fire This Time Festival, people should know about this. The Fire This Time Festival is an incubator off Broadway for emerging Black talent. Satori Hall, Dominique Morisseau, many, many other folks have come through this program, and I'm one of their alums. They did a tribute, and it was called the Alumni Spotlight, works that I had written while I was in residency there and then shortly thereafter. It did very well in November, and I believe they're reprising it in the spring. That's coming up. And then I also know that in October, we're going to have a big showing of my new play, Waiting for a Wake, with Leviathan Theater in partnership with a couple other big theaters around the country. There are some things that'll be happening in the late spring and early summer, so watch out for those. Those dates and details are being formulated. Also, the Celebration Theater Commission on OnlyFans will probably come out in the spring. So just look out on the social medias for all of those different details. There's a lot coming at folks, and there's a lot even more that I'm preparing for next year. So it's a busy time, and I'm very grateful.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks so much. And I hope that your listeners will enjoy it, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.